Normally, I'd be a little bit too chicken to chair a meeting like this, but I've been a friend of Bill W.'s now for about 4.5 years. Not this one, but and I'm kind of partial to Irishmen. So without further ado, I'd like you to help me in welcoming a very warm and kind gentleman that has come to us from Ireland by way of La Jolla, California, the Bill W.
Well, hi, everybody. My name is Bill, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to begin by just expressing my feelings as I find myself right here, right now. I like the company I'm in. I always like to be with my fellow recovering alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel safe in that kind of company. And I feel a presence, a mysterious presence, when I'm with my fellow AAs, because I believe, rightly or wrongly, that in and through you, somebody gets at me in the nicest, kindliest, healthiest way that you could ever imagine. Keeps me sober, keeps me sane, a little bit sane, serene, and competent to enjoy life a day at a time. That's the presence I'm in here. And I want to thank everybody who's responsible for me being here. I don't know how these things come about. I know that Bill must have had something to do with it, the committee must have had something to do with it, and from my heart, I want to say to you all a big, enormous thank you. Thank you. And there are all kinds of people in the background there who just showered attention on me the whole time I've been here. You know, I had heard about Canadian hospitality. Well, it does really exceed all one's expectations. It's really wonderful. And I just want you to know that I love being loved. I love it. I really love it. And I have been loved an awful lot while I was here. And a big, big thank you for it all. Well, now, I've talked to you long enough already to make you realize that I was not born in the United States. I was born where all the good, the real alcoholics come from. Oh, yes. No doubt at all about it. Of course, I want to tell you, you know the difference between an Irish alcoholic and every other kind of an alcoholic? The difference is quite simple. All of you who became alcoholics became bullshitters when you became alcoholics, right? An Irishman doesn't have to wait to become an alcoholic to become a bullshitter. I was over there the year before last, brushing up on my brogue. And I want to tell you, they're the same as they always were. They're the very same. They haven't changed. I was in the city of Dublin, and while I was there, I had the use of a car. I'm not used to driving a car in Ireland. I was in Dublin, and I used to know Dublin when I was young, but downtown Dublin is all one-way streets now. And as I say, I was in this car trying to get to a street, and any time I came anywhere close to it, the arrows were all pointing away, no matter what angle I came at it. So I got frustrated, and I pulled into the curb anyway, and there was a native passing by. And by the way, I had different kind of clothes on. I had a collar on back to front and a black suit. You know that kind of get-up. So I put the window down and I said to this guy, "Hey, Pat, how do I get to Thomas Street?" So he scratched his head and he looked up the street and he looked down the street and he said, "I said, Father, to get to Thomas Street, you wouldn't really start from here at all," he said. I knew I was home. I knew I was home. Haven't changed a bit. They don't have to become alcoholics to get like that. Is Doug still here? Is Doug gone? Is he still here?
He's gone.
He's gone? Oh, I wish he was here. Because while I was over there, there was a story going the rounds about a Texan who was on a vacation over there. God, I wish Doug was here. Apparently, this Texan, he got in with an Irish farmer while he was there, and he asked the farmer to show him around his little farm. So the farmer did, and the Texan took it all in, and he said, "You know," he said, "back on my farm in Texas, give you an idea," he said, "we don't call it a farm, it's a ranch. He said, "to give you an idea, if I got up at sunrise and got into my car to go around my ranch, by the time the sun would have set, I wouldn't have gotten halfway around." And the Irish farmer looked at me and said, "Is that a fact?" he said. "God, you know," he said, "I had a car like that once, too." Oh, boy. Well, that's the kind of company I was born into when I was born. By the way, I was born in the south of Ireland, way down in the south. Not in that mad place up north where they're all crazy. All of them, a whole lot of them, they're all crazy. I was born in a little village in the south of Ireland where everybody was a Roman Catholic because there was nothing else to be. And as soon as I was able to go to school, they sent me to school, sent me to the nuns, of course, teaching in the school. And then I graduated from there to the brothers, the religious brothers. And then I graduated from that, and I went to what was called the classical school, where you were taught by priests. So, as you can imagine, I heard an awful lot about God when I was a kid. God, I got God for breakfast, God for dinner, God. Now, that became an enormous element in my life. An enormous element. When I tell you every time I reflect on my own story, when I look back at it from the vantage point of 13 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I realize more and more as I look back at my life that I was born a nut. I was always a nut. I didn't have to wait to become an alcoholic to become a nut. I know this. I was a nut from the start. Now, you all know that there are different kinds of nuts. And the particular kind of nut that I was a religious nut. You'll see that for yourself. I'm going to tell you what will appear to you a very, very weird story. And then, of course, maybe it won't. And if it won't, then you're in the right place. As far back as I can remember, I had my mind made up what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be a priest. I never remember making a decision to do that. I never remember deciding to do that. As far back as I can remember, to when I was a wee toddler, I had intended to be a priest. Now, if you had asked me way back then, say when I was in grade school or whatever, now why do you want to go in for that? Why that? I would have been very, very embarrassed to tell you, because it would have involved telling you things that were going on inside in me that I didn't want anyone to know about. Very, very private, very, very personal, and of immense importance to me. I told you now in a light-hearted way that I was always awfully conscious of God. And I was, always. Still am. But I know that when I was young and a teenager and a young man and all, it was a kind of a sick kind of consciousness. I know that now. If you would ask me, now why do you want to be a priest? Why? If I were to have told you the truth, it would sound awful. Well, I'll tell you. One of the things that I had heard when I was growing up from the good book was this. What's the biggest thing a human being can do with their life? What's the biggest thing you can do? Bigger than getting to the moon and back, or getting to Mars and back? Bigger than getting the cure for cancer? Bigger than writing the plays of Shakespeare? What's the biggest thing that you can do? And the answer that I had in my little head was to love God. To love God with absolute and total perfection. Do that, you've done the biggest thing a human being can do. It's in the good book. What's the first and the greatest of all the commandments, of all the values, of all the worthwhile things? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, whole soul, whole mind. Do that, you've done the biggest thing a human being can do. And that sank down in there. And I was awesomely aware of this being that demanded to be loved and loved totally. Awesomely aware. I was more aware of him than I was of people I was looking at with my two eyes. When I was a youngster in our little village back home, the church was open all day. And I wouldn't be so much with the other kids. I'd be down in the church. What was I doing there? I don't know. I was lighting candles. I was spattering holy water all over the place. I just wanted to be there. Nuts, nuts, nuts. Yeah. That's the kind of kid I was. And so, as I say, I had my mind made up what I wanted to do with my life. Now, I wasn't going to go in for any kind of a priest, any kind. Oh, not at all, no. I wanted to be the ultimate in dedication and commitment. I wanted to be a monk as well as a priest. Give up absolutely everything. Because you see, I had heard, now don't forget, a person who's nuts, what they're told and what they hear isn't always the same thing. You must allow for that. Now I had heard that if you want to love God with absolute perfection, then there's one thing that you have to do above all else. You've got to make yourself as miserable as you can possibly make yourself. That's the first requirement. You got to give up things, you got to sacrifice all you can get rid of. And so I said to myself, well, if that's the way you go, that's the way you go. And then I heard that if you want to go in for an absolute five-star honors course in this business of loving God perfectly, what you should do is you must leave home and go way out foreign to convert the heathen. And I thought to myself, well, okay. And where in all the world is there more heathen than England? So, don't forget, I was educated in the south of Ireland. So, at the ripe old age of 15, I packed my little bag. I stood in front of my father and mother, and I told them that I was going to go to a prep school over in England run by monks, where I was going to become a monk eventually, and set my hands to the great task of converting England to Christianity. So I set out. My father put me on the boat in Dublin to go over to Liverpool, and I went from there to this prep school in Lancashire run by these monks. And in due course, when I graduated from that school, I went into the monastery and became a monk myself. And I lived the life of a monk in that religious order in England for 30 years. Now, what did all that consist in, life in a monastery? Well, I'll have to be very brief about it because I have to start drinking yet. Well, it was a very severe kind of a life, very, very much given to penance and self-denial and mortification and all that good stuff. We used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And when I say get up, I don't mean we left a nice, comfortable bed. We slept on straw mattresses on a board, supported by trestles. And you got up off of that at 2 o'clock in the morning and you tootled along to the Abbey Church where the whole community of monks sang the praises of God for over an hour. What in the world God wanted his praises sung for at 2 o'clock in the morning? I don't know. It seemed an awful good idea to me at the time. We used to fast 3 days a week. We used to work hard in the fields, support ourselves, grow our own stuff, all that. We used to study a lot, pray a lot. When I was 25, I was ordained a priest as well as being a monk. By the way, the whole purpose of all this life in there in that monastery, it's very simple. The whole purpose of it was to smash ego. Smash ego. We took a vow of poverty. We didn't own anything to call our own, money or goods of any kind. We took a vow of obedience so as not to be doing our own will over anything, but doing the will of the superior who was recognized as being in the place of God himself. And it took a vow of chastity, which meant that we renounced all that had to do with romance and falling in love and getting married and sex and all that lovely stuff. We renounced it all. The whole purpose was to smash ego. You might have read about that in the big book. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Egoism has to be smashed. And that was their way of doing it. Apparently, they've all got the idea that you can't get in touch with God and God can't get close to you unless ego is smashed. And there's one way of doing it. Well, now, when I was 30 years of age, my superiors took it into their heads to do something with me. By this time, I'm 5 years a priest as well as a monk. I was sent to Rome, to a Roman university, to study all kinds of highfalutin stuff. Oh, wonderful stuff. To become a scholar and I couldn't tell you what all. And to get all these degrees. Now, it was when I went to Rome that I found myself living in the head monastery of this religious order. And there were monks in this head monastery in Rome from all over the world who belonged to the same religious order as myself. And they were, a lot of them, going to various Roman universities, and a lot of them were the resident Italian community. And life was conducted in the monastery in the way that life is conducted in Italy. In Rome, you do as Rome does. Now, twice a day, all the monks would assemble in the biggest room in the monastery, which was the dining room. It's called a refectory. And they would have two meals a day in the dining room. And I found myself always sitting in the same place at these big, big, long wooden tables, no tablecloths, everything very stark and austere. And you had the same guy either side of you always. You sat in accordance with your seniority, just like in the service. But all down the middle of these tables were these enormous flagons of wine. Now we're getting on with the business. Huge. There were huge things. There really were. I don't know. They must have dated from the time of the Caesars or something. I don't know. But there they were, and they used to be put out there, positioned one between two monks. And they were put out the way you'd put out a big jug of water. You weren't meant to drink the whole thing. You don't drink a whole jug of water. That's the way they put them out. Well, up to this point in my life, I had never been intoxicated. Never. I celebrated Mass after I was ordained a priest. And in the celebration of Mass, as you probably know, the priest only takes a little quantity of wine in the cup. Now, here I am in a strange country, going to this university every day, studying very, very, very profound, deep, wonderful stuff, expending an awful lot of energy. Anyway, I'm hungry, an empty stomach, every time I come to the refectory, the dining room. Now, the fellow who sat this side of me, with whom I was supposed to share this big flagon here, he would only take that much in the bottom of a glass. The fellow who sat this side of me, who shared the flagon that was there with the fellow the far side of him, he took none at all. He was weird, weird. Very weird. And the fellow the far side of him, he only took that much. So, literally, I found myself with two enormous flagons of wine within arm's reach of me at every meal, twice a day. Well, now nobody had ever told me up to this point in my life What happens when you get drunk? No one had ever told me. And lo and behold, I made this fantastic discovery. What happens when you get smashed? It's fantastic. Why didn't they tell me? Never in my entire life did I experience such a fantastic experience. Oh my, I love to recall it. I love those first days, those first months, my honeymoon with alcohol. Everything was funny, funny, funny. We were supposed to eat in stony, dead silence. Oh, boy. There was a commotion. Anyway, this is how I was introduced to alcohol. I want to tell you that I got drunk twice a day, every day. Gloriously, hilariously, blindly, responsibly drunk. Shouting and roaring and giggling all over the place. And that was just for openers. You see, as I said, there were guys there from all over the world, including a lot of English-speaking ones, like from Canada, Australia, England, Ireland, I couldn't tell you where all, America, of course. And we formed a little community of our own within the big international. See, all those guys were all talking Italian and Spanish, and they were all barbarians. We couldn't have anything to do with it. So we formed a little community on our own. We were far from home, don't you understand? And now we had money that was sent to us by our superiors in our monasteries back home, money for paying our tuition in the university, for buying books, for doing deep research, all that. But we didn't need all the money that we had for those purposes. We had extra, you see. So, as I say, we were far from home, and so we laid in what was necessary for cheering ourselves up, keeping from getting depressed and lonely, you understand. Now, they made my room, we formed this little clique, English-speaking ones, and we used to have parties surreptitiously, and they made my room the bar. By the way, in a monastery, you don't live in a room. You live in a cell, a monk's cell. Some of you may have had experience of that. I don't know. I lived in a cell for 30 years. Anyway, so it was my responsibility to lay in the boodle, and I had shelves in my cell, discreetly covered by a blanket, and bottles upon bottles and bottles at the ready, glasses at the ready, so that whenever a party was declared, we were ready to get launched immediately. Waste no time. Well, what I want to tell you is that my 3 years pursuing all kinds of deep, profound studies in a Roman university are a bit of a blur. I don't remember very much about it at all. All I know was I had a ball. Can you, there I was, set up. Oh, would you believe, we co-opted one Italian, just one young Italian priest, into our group. His family owned a winery outside of Rome. Uh, And I live to see the day when we got a huge big barrel of wine up the back stairs of the monastery, along the cloister and into my cell. So there I was, a big barrel of wine with a faucet on it, rows and rows of bottles, and two big flagons of this stuff at every meal down in the refectory. I think I should just draw a curtain over this whole period of my life. It was wild. It was glorious. It was fantastic. I never used to go out much. Except to school. I went to school. I didn't see any of the sights of Rome. People who have been in Rome for a week have seen more of Rome than I did. And I was there 3 years. I remember seeing St. Peter's one time at a distance. And I thought it was a carousel. It was going around and around. They were great days. Anyway, I got the degrees they sent me out there to get. How, I don't know. I wrote a fantastic dissertation. I have no recollection of writing it. I read it sometimes still, and I said, my God, where did this come from? It's incredible stuff. I came home, by which I mean back to my monastery in England. I was made a professor. I was put to teach the young men who would be the future priests. And I had my mind made up that I was going to put everybody right about absolutely everything. Everything. I was put to teach, and I wasn't, and that was the fulfillment of a secret ambition that I had hugged. I always wanted to be a brilliant scholar, brilliant teacher. And here I was now, with these young minds to be enriched with the depths of my scholarship and profundity. About 3 months after I was on the job, that's how bad it was. Move them on, and that's the way it was for 7 more years. While I was in San Diego, the city of San Diego, I made friends with a family, or rather a family made friends with me. I don't know what way it was. I chose my friends very carefully. The wife in this family herself belonged to a kind of a dynasty. She came from a family who owned a winery. Honest to God. And I was never without the stuff. No problem. And they went on a vacation down to Ensenada in Mexico one summer after I was there in San Diego 7 years. And they invited me to go along with them, which I did. And here I was. They had this enormous trailer on the beach down there. It was about 3 trailers all broken into one. It was a big family. And anyway, towards the end of the vacation time, she, the wife, developed tennis elbow, and the husband had to bring her back up to San Diego to get treatment for this thing. It was driving her crazy. So that left Uncle Bill in charge. Now the kids ranged from a college-aged one, about 22 or up there, right away down to a little nipper this size. A good Catholic family. You understand what I mean, don't you? And so on this particular night when I was on my own, I'd been drinking all day as usual, imbibing the stuff, just pickled. It came to midnight, and there was a radio with a jazz band on it that was driving me insane. So I said, now, listen here, let's Switch that thing off. Let's all go to our beds and have some peace and quiet. And I upended the whiskey bottle into my tumbler, emptied it, threw it in the trash can, and here was my tumbler to go to bed with, the most important one of the day, the one you're going to pass out with, right? So I got up off my chair and I was going across to where my bunk was in one corner of this big trailer. And the eldest son, his name was Matt, stationed himself right in my way. And he had his thumbs in his belt like this. And he was, and the rest of them were all sitting there. And he looked at me with hostility. And he said, "Where do you think you're going?" I said, "I'm going to bed. Where else?" He said, "No, you're not. Not with that." And he pointed at the bumper of whiskey in my hand. I said, "Who said I'm not?" He said, "Funny enough, I did. And I'm going to say something else, Buster. You're the kind of jackass who shouldn't ever drink at all. Because all you are is an ignorant Irish alcoholic." Did you hear that dirty word? Did you hear that? The second time in over 25 years. Did I tell you guys and gals I'm a very brilliant, competent man? An ignorant Irish alcoholic. He said, "You come around my family on a regular basis, freeloading, getting your free liquor, your free stuff, and you think you have some kind of God-given right to it because you wear a bloody collar back to front? I've news for you," he said. "You're not welcome around here." And that goes not just for me, but for all my brothers and sisters there. And they all said, "Yes." I found out afterwards they had all this stuff rehearsed. My mother and father, he said, are too decent to tell you to get lost. But I'm telling you. Just you get lost. We don't want the likes of you around here. Because all you are is a bum and a drunk. Well, nobody ever talked to me like that before. And I went to go past him with dignity. And he made a grab at the bumper of whiskey and he knocked it out of my hand. That was the last whiskey in the house. And when that happened, something happened inside me here that I never know how to describe. There was an explosion, a silent, atomic, volcanic eruption inside here, under my sternum bone. I just was swept away with fury and anger like I have never, ever experienced in my whole life. And I wanted to get at that guy and put those fingers and thumbs around his throat and squeeze. I wanted to see his eyes bulge out. I wanted to see him drop blue all over. And I made for him. And I would have killed him. God, I was mad. Pure, incontrollable rage. And the rest of them pulled me off him. The screaming and shouting and hollering was unbelievable. I half wrecked that trailer that night. And I stormed out of there, and I knew there was a bar open up the beach. It'd be open till 2 o'clock. And I went up there, and I bought me a bottle. I pray to God it's the last booze I will ever buy or ever drink. And I lay out on the beach, and I drank that bottle until I passed out. And I woke up when the sun was well up, and I stood up, and I remembered every single thing that had happened in the trailer. And I could see the trailer down the beach, and I said, I'm not going near them. And I looked out at the waves on the Pacific Ocean, and I had a recall. I remember the very first time as a boy I'd ever seen waves. It was when I stood on that little boat going across from Dublin to Liverpool as a 15-year-old boy. And I had a dream. And I remember saying to myself now, looking out at the waves in the Pacific Ocean, you've come a long way, baby. Boy, have you ever. That little boy going across the Irish Sea years before was setting out to love God perfectly, to become an instrument in God's hands for doing good things for God's people. And now as I look back, I said, my God, what has become of you? You wanted to kill a man last night. You actually wanted to kill him. I did. And I would have if there had been no one around. And I had a recall of all the mad situations I'd got myself into. Always over booze. Nothing but booze. The most shameful, disgusting, outrageous situations. The fights, the arguments, the breakup of happy relationships with my colleagues, with authority figures, the smashing of everything that I valued in my life. There came over me a realization of what drinking had been in my life. The wrecker. And the self-destruction, the massive self-destruction that I had involved myself in. In a way that had never happened before, it all came down on me. And I remember saying to myself, you're not going to quit drinking as a result of this, because, buddy, you can't. You have tried before, and I had. And you're not going to go on living, continuing drinking, because you'll either kill someone or get killed with a temper like yours. You can't go on living with it, and you can't live without it. Now, what are you going to do? And the most awful despair that I had ever experienced in my life just gripped me. And I became terrified, absolutely terrified. I felt like you would feel at the bottom of a snake pit with no way of getting up out of there. I looked over at the trailer and I saw the kids had all left. And I went back there and I put my belongings together. I had my own car. And I came flying back up to San Diego. And it was the end of the vacation, and I had to be back on the job pretty soon. And I had a commitment to do a big preaching job up in Los Angeles, in a place called Alhambra, in the Carmelite Church there. Now, there was something I wanted to do before I went back on duty that I needed to do and that I hadn't done for years. I felt filthy, stinking. I felt like a pariah. I wanted to get somehow to do something symbolic of reaching out to God and asking him to grab a hold of me. I wanted to go to confession, a thing I hadn't done in a long time. And I wasn't going to go to some fellow priest who knew me, no way. So I went up to Los Angeles, which is a different diocese from my diocese of San Diego, and I had the directory in my car of the clergy, and I looked up addresses. Names meant nothing to me, just addresses that I knew I could find of parish houses, rectories. And I picked on one that I thought would be easy to find off the freeway. And I ended up on the doorstep of that address and rang the doorbell. And an old, crabby-looking old priest answered the door. I was in my regimentals. And I said, "Father," I said, "I wonder would you mind hearing my confession?" "Oh, sure, Father," he said, "come right in." So I went in. And he sat in his armchair and I knelt down at his side, and I was shaking all over. I was perspiring from every pore. My clothes were soaked in perspiration. I was stinking to high heaven. And I started in to tell him what I could remember of what I call my crimes. It was an awful, awful load. And I knew all I could tell him was only a small fraction. But I told him. And he had his elbow on the arm of the chair, and he looked at me in the most bored way when I was through. And he said, "Why did you come along to me with all this garbage?" I thought that was an awful strange question. I said, "I came to get God's forgiveness for my sins. What the hell else?" "Oh," he said, "I know, but why did you pick on me?" "Oh," I said, "because you don't know me, I hope." "Oh," he said, "you needn't worry, I don't. And furthermore, I don't want to." "But," he said, "I know a heck of a lot more about you than you know about you. I know, for instance, exactly what's wrong with you. All that's wrong with you is, and you don't like hearing it, you're an alcoholic, period. That's all. That's it. That's the whole of it. You're an alcoholic. But you don't know from beans what that word means. It's because you think you do that you want to murder people who tell you you are." And he started in to tell me what it means to be an alcoholic. All it means is, alcohol is a drug, you're allergic to that drug, it goes all around your system, it goes through your brain, and because you're allergic to it, it programs your brain to think all kinds of shit. And to think you're thinking all kinds of wisdom. You're programmed not merely to think nonsensically and back to front about everybody and everything, especially about booze, but you're programmed to feel all the feelings you feel. You're programmed to say the things you say, to engage in all these mad, insane, self-destructive behaviors. You're programmed to. You're just like a puppet on a string. You couldn't not carry on that way. He said, "All this stuff you've told me, there isn't a single sin in the whole thing from beginning to end." He said, "There couldn't be." Because, he said, "to commit a sin, as you should well know, you have to be a mature, responsible human being." "So you haven't a thing to worry about. Not a thing. You haven't committed a single sin ever since the first drink that you took, which sent you over the border. From that point on, your potential to become an alcoholic, which was there the whole time, was activated, and then here you are, an alcoholic under the influence of alcohol, doing what an alcoholic is programmed to do. That's all." He said, "There isn't even reason for me giving you God's forgiveness. There's nothing to forgive here. Nothing." And the whole time I was kneeling there, I was saying to myself, "My God, what have I walked into here?" " Are there two lunatics in this room? Or only one? And if one, which? You know, it says in this big book, we stood at the turning point. I knelt at the turning point. And I thought, you know, should I stand up and close my fist and let this joker have it right in the teeth and tell him, look here, Buster, I came in here in mortal sin, which if I died in, I'd be damned for all eternity. Now, you don't give me this goddamn chloroform. You give me what you're paid for giving me. I didn't know whether to say that to him or kneel there and let this thing go on. But some sixth sense was whispering at me. Now listen, buddy. You're hearing what you need to hear for the first time in your entire life. Now listen. And then he said something that clinched it. I had told him that I had sort of looked at addresses and picked out one. He said, you think you came here by some kind of a fluke? I've news for you, buddy. You didn't come here by a fluke. You were brought here, right here to where you're at, right here, right now, you were brought here. Because he said, let me tell you something about me. I'm an alcoholic. I've been more of an alcoholic than you've ever been. And I'm an alcoholic in an outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't know from beans what that means either, so let me tell you. And he did. He told me. And he said, I'm the only priest in Alcoholics Anonymous for miles around here. And if you think you came here by a fluke, you are even stupider than you look. I guess you all know when Catholics go to this confession thing, at the end of it all, they get a penance, things, prayers to say and things to do. He said, now, for your penance, for this lot, he said, you're not getting three Hail Marys, three rosaries, any of that stuff, he said. For your penance, you get your ass to an AA meeting. Which is what I did that very night, and he brought me. And here I've been ever since. The most fantastic trip imaginable. Totally fantastic. I wish I hadn't wasted so much time telling you what a jackass I've been, so as to leave myself time to tell you what it's been like since I found you lot. It's been unimaginable. When I came into this program, I got me a sponsor who was a red-headed fella. His name was Richard. He had no religion of any kind. But he had marvelous serenity. And I had heard his story, and he had been in a penitentiary for knocking the brains, for really killing people. Really. He knocked their brains out with the butt end of rifles like you break eggs. Oh, he had quite a few resentments. He didn't like the way life had treated him. I identified with that guy like you wouldn't believe. And I went along and I said, Richard, I said, will you be my sponsor? He looked at me and said, aren't you the guy? Are you a Roman Catholic priest? Oh, I said, don't hold that. Oh, jeez, no, he said, I couldn't deal with you. I couldn't deal with you at all. He said, what do you want me for? Look, Richard, I said, I have had a hell of a life. I've had a terrible temper. It'll kill me. It'll get me killed eventually. I said, you have traveled from A to B, from being a bad-tempered person to being a man with serenity. I want to make that. I want to make that trip. I really do. I really do. There is nothing I need more. For God's sake, please, show me how to do it. Well, he said, okay, but it's going to be on my terms. I said, whatever, whatever. Okay, he said. Now, what you have to do is come to meetings, read the big book, call me twice a day, tell me what you're thinking, what's going on inside you, what's going on around you, and I will tell you what to think about all that, and you think it. He said, you've got to get rid of all your old ideas. The result is going to be nil until you do. And he says, when the big book tells us that, it means exactly what it's saying. Exactly and precisely what it's saying. You have got to get rid of every idea was ever planted in that diseased mind of yours. And I don't care who the hell planted it there, whether it was nuns in a village in Ireland, whether it was the Bible, whether it was a Roman university, every goddamn thing was ever planted in there, you get rid of. The result is going to be nil until you do. I don't want to hear any Bible stuff from you. I don't want to hear any Roman Catholic stuff. I don't hear any religion. I want to hear none of it. Forget it, he said. Did I tell you I'm a very brilliant man? I looked at him and said, Richard, why? He said, for a very simple reason. You're allergic to alcohol because you're an alcoholic. But you're also, and when you say you're allergic to alcohol, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with alcohol. It just means there's something wrong with you. You can't process that stuff normally, that's all. But he said, because you're an alcoholic who's also a Roman Catholic, you are allergic to Roman Catholicism. Doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with that stuff necessarily. Could be fine stuff for all I know, he says, but you're allergic to it. It's what's causing your disease, contributing to your disease. Get rid of it, buddy. And put in its place what's in there. And absorb what you're listening to at meetings. And you'll get well. Don't. And you won't. Well, I phoned him twice a day, and all time went on. Then he said, well, now, have you read the big book? Yeah, I said, yes, I've read the big book, Richard, up to the stories. He said, did you read the chapter of the agnostic? Richard, I said, you know the job I'm in. Did you read the chapter? No, I said, I didn't. Well, read the thing. Oh, God. And then he said to me, but before you do, let me tell you how to read it. Because a smart ass like you doesn't even know how to read that, he said. Because the minute you open it, oh yes, for agnostics, you're going to tell yourself, ah yeah, now they're going to tell me how to prove that there's a God, how you prove there's a God to someone who has problems about it. He said, as long as you think that that's what that chapter is all about, you won't get what's down there on those pages. It won't get into your head. You'll be telling yourself something that's not there at all. He said, that chapter is not written to try to prove to jackasses like you that there's a God. It's written for an entirely more marvelous purpose. It's written with a view to get you to do something, something perfectly simple, which if you do, it'll make it possible for God to prove to you that there is a God. And that's something totally different. Now, he said, read it. and see what it's telling you to do to make it possible for God, if he wants to prove to you that there's a God. This chapter is the most fantastic thing I have ever read in my entire life. I have read the whole Bible, yeah. I have read much more besides in 30 years in a monastery. I have read an awful lot in a Roman university. I have read nothing that comes within billions of light years to compare with the wisdom of what's in this chapter. Let me tell you. It's all I want to leave here and go back to San Diego, and when I've left you with this, I'll go back happy. And I'm nearly finished, but this is what I want to leave you with. This chapter to the agnostic simply draws our attention to the fact we're living in a weird and wonderful world. So it says, wonder. Wonder, that's all. You sow a seed in the soil, a flower grows. Good heavens. That's wonderful. If it happened immediately, you'd jump sky high. The fact that it happened slowly doesn't make it any less wonderful. So wonder, wonder. How does that happen? Birds lay eggs, and the eggs become birds and fly away. Good heavens. It's wonderful. You look at a steel girder and you say, yeah. But let an atomic scientist introduce you to what's there. It's a mass of atoms. And look down into the atoms. And there's little fellas birling around, giving off energy at the speed that they're going around with. And here's all these fellas holding up huge buildings by birling around like mad, holding up these buildings. The thing's fantastic. All kinds of weird and wonderful things. There are other things going on too. Starvation, violence, pain, destruction, horrible. So you look at it all. I wonder, did it all come about by chance? Or is there an intelligence, a benign, wonderful, marvelous intelligence? I wonder. That's all. I wonder. You have to wonder when you look at the damn thing. So will you please wonder? That's all. And when you've wondered and you're saying to yourself one minute, oh, there has to be. Maybe there is. Which is only another way of saying maybe there isn't. And then you're saying maybe there isn't. That's only another way of saying maybe there is. How do you get from maybe-ing about it all, maybe, to saying, I know for darn sure and certain there is? How do you make that transition? Page 55. Read it, digest it, get it off by heart, keep on reading it. 5 sentences, listen to them. We finally came to see that faith in some kind of God might not be as irrational as we had hitherto supposed. Not a lovely sentence. Very guarded, huh? Might not be as irrational. But how to make the transition to saying, I know there is. Here's how. We had to search fearlessly. And Richard looked at me and he said, does that remind you of any step? Oh, yes, I said, the 4th step. Brilliant, he said. Keep coming back. We had to search fearlessly. Where? We found the great reality deep down within our own selves. In the last analysis, it is only there he can be found.
Normally, I'd be a little bit too chicken to chair a meeting like this, but